My very special guest in this edition of the Alternate History Show in the Feedback Hub is a guy who's been on the show before. He was on talking about a book that he'd compiled, an anthology that he'd compiled last year. And we'll talk more about that later on as well, actually, along with a whole host of other things AH related. David Flynn, hello.
Hello there.
Tell us how you got into alternate history. Just remind us of how you got into it, because I understand it was through your second wife.
My first wife.
Your first wife, sorry about that, yes.
Way back in the 1990s, back when the internet was still a strange and bizarre thing,
there was still
website called Sock History What If. She was fairly keen on that. Yeah. I merely went along as expert opinion on certain topics that I'd had some experience of. That was the lead-in. She died of cancer back in 2002 while in the middle of doing a timeline. I took the timeline over and finished that, and as a result of that got hooked onto the alternate history business.
And here you are now. I mean, tell us about your expertise. Why did your wife think, David will know what to do, he'll know about alternate history, he'll be able to help me out. Why was that exactly?
I've had what might loosely be called an interesting life. I'm the sort of person who, traditional book authors who have these strange list of things that they've done in the past, that's me. When I left school, I joined the Royal Marines and moseyed about with them doing interesting bits, some of it fun, some of it a bit less fun. For example, I got caught up in the Lebanese Civil War for a short while in Beirut, effectively getting refugees out of a war-torn city. I was involved in the Falklands campaign, and having been in the Marines for over a decade, I was a bit of an expert on amphibious warfare. At the time on Sock History What If, people were making interesting claims about Operation Sea Lion, which was an amphibious operation.
Yeah.
And so I got called in as an expert on, no, it is not sensible to do this in this way. I've built power stations, I've been bodyguard to some fairly important people, and generally messed around getting the sort of CV that people look at and say, don't be ridiculous.
And it stood you in very good stead for your alternate history work, particularly your publishing, because you worked in publishing quite a lot as well.
When I was building power stations, I did my back in. I got into trade press publishing, writing about building power stations. I became an editor of a magazine. That was my introduction to journalism and publishing. And from writing practical things about diesel engines and gas turbines and nuclear power plants, and believe me, there is nothing new to write about a diesel engine. The only difference between diesel engines is the colour they're painted. Started playing about with writing fiction. The fiction has taken over, and I'm essentially retired from doing the practical power station stuff.
Yes.
And now I'm fiction writer, and from that point I got grumbling about publishers, how awful publishers were, etc., etc. And the point was made to me, well, why don't you try doing it?
Yes.
So I did, hence Sergeant Frosty Publishing.
Yes, Sergeant Frosty Publishing. There's a lot of alternate history related publishing lately. Have you noticed that, of course, with the rise of Sea Lion Press and lots of other things as well, lots of other outlets that perhaps weren't available over the past 10 years?
Yes, Sea Lion Press has come along. A number of the mainstream authors, Harry Turtledove, for example, has become increasingly popular. It's become mainstream. There have been various films. But of course, alternate history as a genre has been around for a very, very long time. We can trace it right back to Mark Twain, at least.
Were you aware, before you got dragged almost into alternate history, that it existed as a genre in its own right? And did you think about perhaps alternate scenarios without perhaps thinking that there was a genre?
When I was initially being dragged in, as you describe it, my view tended to be alternate historians were effectively failed historians, that the actual history got complicated and so they invented the little bits to tidy things up. At the time, I was fairly dismissive of it, without realizing that in order to write something different, you've first of all got to know what it's like to start with. If you start making changes without understanding the initial premise, you're screwed.
What else do you do other than alternate history publishing then? I'm guessing you write other books of other genres then.
Indeed. I mean, Sergeant Frosty Publishing, which is the one that I run, that's historical fiction and other sorts of fiction for children and young adults. This effectively grew out of bedtime stories, which I argue is one of the purest forms of storytelling there is. You have to be very responsive to what your audience wants, even if it's just two children and you're trying to get them settled for bed, and judging how to tell a story that will keep them interested but will also enable them to move into the going to sleep. I have a lot of time for children's fiction and young adult fiction. When it's done well, you have to accept its own internal logic, but it has to be very consistent within that logic. You can have things like dragons turning up, but the dragons can't be one thing at one point and something completely different at another point. If they are big scary monsters at the start, you can't then introduce dragons as being cute and fluffy.
Well, arguably as well, the bedtime story, apart from anything else, is the first type of story that anyone gets introduced to in their lives. So
absolutely,
it all starts with that. Tell us then about your brushes with AH in more detail. What's your proudest AH moment then over the past 20 years or so since you've been involved in the community?
The finally getting the AH community to realise that Operation Sea Lion as a viable plan left something to be desired. Alison was the initial person who developed the phrase alien space bats.
ASB, as it's called on certain boards.
Absolutely. She'd turn in her grave as to how it's used now. Originally, it was used as a rhetorical device to demonstrate that things couldn't happen. On Operation Sea Lion, someone was suggesting, well, if you give the German fighter aircraft drop tanks, that would have changed everything. And it was the calculations, even if we assume that the German fighters can stay up 24/7, that they never need to go back to refuel, the pilots never need rest, they're still overtasked. You can just do the numbers and there aren't enough fighters to do all the things that they're supposed to do. If alien space bats give this power, it's still not enough. It was a rhetorical device to demonstrate how things couldn't happen. Now it's been transformed into alien space bats do things and magic happens. We don't need to worry about the logic at the start, which would have depressed her.
Okay, but then the sort of phrase is still employed in the way that she envisaged as well, because that's how I envisaged it when I first came across alternate history, which would have been around about 2009-2010 time. I didn't, of course, know how the phrase alien space bats came about at the time, but obviously I sort of worked out from the discussions what it was all about, basically, if that makes sense. So were you the one that came up with the unmentionable sea mammal phrase then?
No, that was somebody else. I'm not entirely sure where it came from, but it was someone trying to avoid the use of ASB and coming up with an alternate version of it, which is rather nice. That's the way language develops. Different people generate different concepts and it all blends together. I can't take credit for that.
Can you take credit for any other AH terminology?
I have to really come back to Sergeant Frosty, which was a long time in the brewing. There are now a lot of Sergeant Frosty stories and other people are starting to tell them, which pleases me no end. Originally, a bunch of Marines, including myself, were on an exercise in North Norway. The premise of the exercise was, how quickly can we reinforce it should the Soviets decide to launch a massive tank invasion through Arctic Norway? I am not a strategic genius, but that sounds like nonsense to me.
Yeah.
The end result was, there we were, a bunch of Marines on a hilltop in North Norway in winter on a hill, and we had crates of supplies and a lot of snow. Time passed, we got very bored, the crates got emptied, and we had a whole lot of planks of wood, which we converted into effectively skis, which we built snowmen on and pushed them down the hill slope. We were young men and very bored.
I can think of less productive ways to spend a bit of time when you're bored. I really can.
One of the snowmen survived not one, not two, but three trips down on this rickety ski to get down to the bottom, and we decided that this snowman had to be a sergeant because sergeants are indestructible. That was way back in 1972, and at the back of my mind, the sort of the sergeant snowman was a concept. Mm-hmm. Time came when I started telling bedtime stories to Andrew, my eldest son. He's now at university and is 21 and would be really embarrassed on hearing this. But he first heard the story of the sergeant snowman who got named Sergeant Frosty. Sergeant Frosty was born, and since then he's been involved in many, many adventures, and it's rather taken off. And I'm quite pleased at the way that something so stupid has become accepted.
You know, I was beginning to think, and this is alternate history in itself, perhaps, that you were about to tell me that you were the inspiration for the film The Snowman at that point.
No, certainly Sergeant Frosty Adventures have taken on a mythology of their own.
Exactly.
I'm not taking credit for The Snowman.
Well, let's talk then about what you're doing at the moment, because very exciting time. Last year, when we had you on, we had you ostensibly to talk about Towards a Better Future, which was a Ukraine anthology which came out, of course. There is a sequel, which is coming out appropriately enough on February the 24th. Which will be, of
That's
course, the year anniversary.
Plan. Yes, there's a sequel coming out. When we were produced Building a Better Future, that was done in something of a rush.
Yes.
At the time, we thought that the war would be over fairly quickly. Well, as alternate historians go, we got that one wrong. It was produced very quickly with the intention of helping with reconstruction.
Yes.
Well, the war is still ongoing. There's still going to be a huge need for reconstruction. This is a more leisurely version. It's called 10 Years Later, which I believe was a suggestion that came out in the podcast that we had discussing the Building a Better Future.
There you go.
I think it was yourself suggested, well, for a sequel, 10 years later. Well, that's what we're doing. The premise is 10 years later, and people are imagining how things will be further down the line.
Yes.
I'm currently in the process of receiving submissions. I've got 5 proofed submissions. I'm looking for between 10 and 12 total at the end. We've got an interesting range so far. One is a romance, two people damaged by war. War is going to do an awful lot of damage to an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
And basically, they're helping reconstruct each other, as it were. There's one about heroism and the changing nature of heroism according to the different circumstances that it finds itself in.
Yeah.
You're starting off with the needs of the soldier as a hero, then the needs of the builder as a hero, then the needs of a psychological support there. Forgiveness is a thing.
Yes.
Someone looking at how is Ukraine and Russia going to normalize relations in the end. It's got to happen somehow. Yeah. I have no idea how it's going to happen, but if it's a constant border skirmish, that's going to be a terrible position. We're getting a nice range of stories in, still open for submissions, and I've given myself a nice gentle 2 months to produce it, but February the 24th is the obvious target date for publication.
Who have you got working on the project? Last year, of course, you had quite a few individuals, Alex Wallace, Charlton Cousins, and a few others. Who's working on it this time?
Jack Tyndale has promised to do the cover. Sean Hazlett, Alex Wallace, and Andy Cook from the previous version, they've contributed. A Nepali citizen, Binod Dawadi, he's the one who's done the hero transforming. There's about half a dozen I've received definite stories from.
Yes.
I'm always a bit careful about saying that so-and-so will be in when all I've received is an expression of interest, because I'm aware that expressions of interest don't always translate to received work. Acceptable story in time for that. And if I say someone is going to be in and it turns out they have an accident or for one reason or another can't produce in time, that wouldn't be fair to them.
But we have a few submissions so far which will be included.
That's correct.
Okay, lovely. David, you've got a very busy month next month then, because that's going to be published at the end of February. And in a few weeks' time, on February the 8th, we'll be recording it, I think. We're going to be doing a podcast on 1066 and all that, and you're going to be the main contributor. We were particularly interested in doing an episode on 1066. Why was that?
Well, 1066, it's a key point, and it's one of those what used to be termed a brittle time. There are certain places that are resilient, and it doesn't really matter what you do in the POD, it all tends to go back to the same thing. A classic example of the resilient point of departure is the Trent Crisis during the American Civil War.
Yes.
In that case, both America and Britain had absolutely no reason to go to war, and trying to get them to go to war over the Trent Crisis is incredibly difficult, and whatever you do, it always comes back to the point of view they decide that they have better things to do than get involved.
Yes, America, of course, fighting a civil war, and Britain has no interest in getting involved with that particular conflict at any
absolutely.
Level. Yes.
Best case, Britain gains nothing. Worst case, it loses Canada. It has got nothing to gain. At the time, the United States are really busy at the moment trying to deal with the Confederacy. They have better things to do than to get involved with the superpower of the day. They both have absolutely no interest in fighting and every interest in coming to a settlement and trying to get the Trent Crisis into a full-blown war. A lot of people have tried, and I've yet to see one that convinces. 1066 is completely the opposite. There are so many ways that it could have gone slightly differently. You've got the Norse, you've got the Normans, you've got the Saxons. If things had happened in a slightly different order, the outcome of any of the battles could have been very different. You've got Fulford Gate, you've got Stamford Bridge, Hastings.
Of course.
They can be done differently. You've also got Swain and the Danes wondering about getting involved. So there's a fourth party already involved. Then you've got the Scots and the Welsh keen on raiding and nibbling off bits if they can. It's a very chaotic situation, and it's very, very easy to get a totally different outcome from whatever happens. And you need to take a careful step-by-step approach to work out what is going to happen and how it all feeds in.
Which
also, because there are so many actors involved, so many interests, it's a chaotic mess. That's always fun for an alternate historian.
Oh yes, we'll be getting our teeth into that, and it'll be perfect discussion fodder. David, many thanks for joining us today and talking about your general interest in alternate history. Is there anything else you want to say before we head off, actually?
I received my author's copy of my latest book, The Nitpicker's Guide to Ancient Military. I got tired of seeing on films things like Roman soldiers breaking ranks and rushing forward to join in melee combat with Germanic war bands, Robin Hood firing a flaming arrow which pierces someone and they burst into flames, and all that. And it's effectively a look at how it was done historically, how various films do it, some good, some bad, and some different. why some films do it a different way. Often it's just simply a matter of safety for the extras. If you have a large cavalry charge with lots of people shoulder to shoulder, people are going to fall off, you're going to have a few deaths, and whilst you can do that in a cavalry charge, the extras complain about it if you try doing it like that in real life. And it's just a fun bit of comparing how it was done and how it's been presented.
Before you go, David, give us a quick plug of Sergeant Frosty Publishing. How can people discover all the work of David Flynn?
The website is www.sergeantfrosty.com. If you go there, you'll come to the page where it shows what has been newly published, and there's also a page showing all the things that we've produced over the last 3 years now.